This is Sherlanya, and in this episode, AADL talks to Keith Alexander. Keith Alexander grew up with a mother who didn't believe in working a 9-to-5 job. In fact, she didn't feel bound by rules at all. Here, Keith talks about his memoir, Forgery of the Month Club, and what it was like being raised by a petty thief. The first thing I'm going to ask you to do is describe your book a little bit. Give me the Cliff's Notes version of your book.
Well, I grew up with a mother who was a burglar and an art forger and an all-around criminally minded woman who was from Minnesota who had an IQ of like 200, and she just did not want to go straight. We grew up really, really poor, and I hated it. And I was kind of her collaborator, for lack of anything else to do, because I was hoping one day she would use some of her genius and become a millionaire. We could all live on Easy Street. But that never happened. So the memoir is really kind of a chronological look at all of these crazy adventures and misadventures that I either witnessed or I was part of growing up in Chicago in the Humboldt Park, Logan Square area.
Sure. Your memoir was very exciting. There were so many misadventures and so many adventures. And I found myself like just 20 pages in. I was like, wait. You know this guy lived. You've seen him. This guy's not going to die.
No, I'm right here.
But the stuff I was reading, if I didn't know you, I'd be like, is this guy going to make it to the end? Because there were many, many places where I felt like, ooh, if I did not know that he was a living person, I'd be like, this is it. Did you have that experience while you were living some of these things?
Of course. Absolutely had those. Where most of this stuff happened was in a neighborhood in Chicago at the time in the 70s and the 80s that was largely ignored. And it was really known by the residents as the Wild Wild West. And so it was really kind of an enclave where we grew up pretty much living the way we wanted to live, not just my mother and I, but everybody in the neighborhood. And there were a lot of people who were killed or ended up in prison. And I knew that I had the same fate if I didn't change something in my life. I can't change my mother. Would that I could.
Did you try?
Of course. That's pretty much what the book's about. It's like, Ma, why don't you do something legal? She devised a way to scale a statue and scrape the gold flakes off of it and melt the things down. I mean, somebody who could do that
could have done anything
legally and made a good living at least, if not millions of dollars, at least a good living. Yeah.
What was her aversion to going straight, as you call it, or as she calls it, or as you both call it?
You know, when I first started writing the book, it began as like an investigative report to figure out why she would do that.
Mm-hmm.
And I could never figure out why. Until towards the end, somebody suggested that she might have a narcissistic behavioral disorder, which sounds kind of right. I wish I'd known that when I was growing up. That would have recontextualized everything for me.
Well, unfortunately, none of us get manuals to our parents, right?
Yeah, nor do we get manuals to be a parent.
Oh,
but I'll tell you.
No, we don't.
I'll tell you, though, this upbringing that I had, this kind of wild upbringing, actually prepared me quite well to be a father of a daughter who had a lot of serious health issues.
Mm-hmm.
Because it really called on me to think out of the box, to draw on reserves I didn't know that I had, but more than anything, to fight. Because, you know, a lot of what's in this memoir is really a fight for me to find myself, to define my own masculinity in the face of no father. And so, in a lot of ways, writing the book for me was, it first started out as an investigative report, and then it became a place for me to map out my own feelings about everything that I had experienced, especially in the context of now being a father. And one of the things that really became clear to me was that my father, who was really indifferent and not around very much at all, he was a black man, he was a professional, he was a lawyer, went to the University of Chicago Law School. So he's a very well-educated, intelligent man who just had other priorities. Without knowing, really, that that was probably the best example he could be for me, not having a father, because I know what it's like to not have a father, and I know how powerful it could be for me to be a presence for my daughter.
Sure.
So the absence of my father actually made me a better father by being around. Because there's something that children draw on that's almost, it's nonverbal, but they get when their parents are around, even if you're not doing anything. In fact, I just read an article the other day about you don't really have to do anything with your children. As long as they know that you're there, then they tend to do better.
Interesting. It's an interesting position to be in where you're reading the book of a person that you know by sight. You visit the library often. I see you with your daughter. I see you giving her the freedom to explore the things that she's interested in. And normally you wouldn't know that about a person. You just pick their book up. But reading about this clear absence of a father, it made me wonder, did you just decide, I will never be like that as a father, and what can I do to not be like that? Did it just work out that way? Is it something that you think about often? One of the passages that really stood out to me was when you found out that your father died. Found out he died in sleep in his favorite chair. Hung up the phone. That was that. As a daughter, I can't imagine that. It's interesting to think about that as a parent. What would I have to do to have that be the experience that my son had? Tell me about that moment. Tell me about what you were thinking when you were writing about that.
At that moment, that was like in 92, I think it was. And by then, I'd run through all of the different colors of my anger for whatever at my father. Actually, I hadn't run through all the colors of anger at him. I was in the middle of being angry with him. And I'd moved away. I was in San Diego. And when I got the call, I know what it was. I'd gotten a call before saying your father had an embolism. He was dying. You got to go to the hospital. The whole family converged on the hospital, right? And then he didn't die. And this was after I got complete with him about, well, Pop, I always hated you for this. And I love you for this. And I wish you were around more. And then the guy didn't die. And so I was like, damn, man. Keep in mind, I was still angry. And I had to pay money to fly back from San Diego to Chicago. And so I was really pissed. I was like, damn, man, you didn't even die. So, I mean, obviously, I was pretty angry. And I really hadn't forgiven him until years after he had died. And I think part of seeing the freedom to forgive him came as a result of working on the memoir. I mean, it took me 14 years to write this memoir. And it wasn't because there was that much to write about. It was really, I had to consider it carefully from a lot of different angles. Does this explain why my mother was the way she was? What's my emotional state when I'm going through all of these different things? You know, and one's emotional state changes constantly. I mean, you can think about the way your father was on Monday and feel pretty pissed off about him. And on Wednesday, you have the same thoughts, but you might not feel as bad because who you were on Monday is completely different. And the way you relate to your memories and your feelings and stuff changes as well.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
But you were asking about my father, and I just want to jump on something here that has really been an issue for me is defining my masculinity. I mean, that was something that I remember struggling with as a child.
Tell me more about that.
Well, you know, my mother's white. I'm this brown little kid, and I'd look at the girls, and I'd have crushes, and I'd fantasize, and that's as far as it would go because I either didn't have the confidence or didn't know that I could believe in myself in order to talk to women. But for me, that's kind of followed me since then. I mean, I've never really resolved that. It's a source of frustration for me. It's a big missing.
So what would that look like for you? I want to unpack that a little bit.
Well, I think I'd be able to go up and talk to a woman and not feel so insecure about it. I mean, it's interesting. I grew up with two women. Mm-hmm. I grew up with my mother and my sister until my sister left the house at like 16 or so. And I would think that that would give me some insight into women, but apparently they were the wrong examples. I've always yearned to have a male take an interest in me and sort of assume the missing roles that I had as I was growing up.
Sure.
And so I've always had this kind of, I don't know, an openness for that. It's never really happened, and it's not like I need it, but emotionally that yearning is there.
Sure.
And also, if I'm at a party and I see a beautiful woman, I wish I could go up to her and talk to her, but usually I don't.
You had to construct an identity that was totally different. Most of the footholds that most people have just seems like you didn't have them, or they were just arranged in a different way. It just seems like you have had to build and construct things that maybe many people just have. You had to make an active choice, for example, to try to get out of there. It seems like that was definitely a struggle. If you're raised in a place where the rules are different than everywhere else, which is what this seems like, how do you operate somewhere else? Some people are raised with a different rule book, and they all know their rule book is different. But you knew your rule book was different. Your rule book was so different that you had no choice but to know. When you tried to get out the first time, when you're like, I'm going to the Navy, you had to actively make this choice. So it's not like you were like, I don't know that this is going to be difficult. You went in there knowing that.
Well, actually, I didn't. I mean, really? Intellectually, you know what the military is all about.
Yeah.
But emotionally,
I mean,
again,
it was going to be different than your
world. But
you probably knew that it was going to be more different from your world than it would be from the next guy's world.
I was looking for difference. I wanted to get out of that neighborhood. I wanted to just get some sort of normalcy in my life.
That's what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
You didn't get to start from normalcy.
Well, for me, that was normal. For me, having the gay crowd around smoking pot and cashing in on their scams was normal. I mean, the house was filled with love. I was too young to understand what was going on. I didn't understand about oppression of gay men and women. I didn't understand about shoplifting. When my mother started explaining to me and other people started explaining to me about the stealing of the bicycles and the burglary, I had to make a choice right then as a child. Do I judge my mother or do I cling to her?
Sure.
You know, and she was the only parent I had. Much of the reason I stuck with her through these misadventures was because I was really conflicted about leaving her. Because mm-hmm. in a dangerous neighborhood, she could have ended up dead easily.
Oh, yeah. And as in a dangerous neighborhood, as a woman who pulled off some big scams, when you guys had to evict those mm-hmm. folks.
Well, that was a time when the neighborhood was watching because everybody gossiped in the neighborhood. And these people live right next door. It was our property. And everybody knew this woman's history. She would just bounce from house to house and stay there a year at a time and not pay anything at all. And so when she moved in with us, nobody told us. Nobody said anything to us about this, even though it was clear to everybody what she was doing. So that was a rough time.
So I am curious about how you came to Michigan, because I saw that you were in Chicago for a while, saw that you were in California for a while, and then we got the story of your daughter's entry into your life. By that time, you were in Michigan, right?
Yeah. Yeah, so Hannah was born in Michigan.
I'm curious, what brought you to Michigan?
Well, when I moved out to California, I moved out there to live with a woman that I had met mm-hmm. who was rooming with my niece. They were both at Berkeley together. And she got 5 job offers. One of them was here in Ann Arbor at U of M. And since it was close to Chicago, she asked me which one she should take. I said, take Michigan.
Sure.
She chose Michigan. And then I had a year left on my grad program at San Diego. And then I followed her.
I was describing your book to someone else. I was like, I'm going to interview this guy. He was raised by this champion hustler, a top level, which has to be a sort of education unto itself. Because this lady, talk about think outside the box. She is like the poster woman of thinking outside the box. I don't even think she has a box. It's clear through your book that you got like a crash course in survival, but there are some very highbrow, sophisticated elements of what she was teaching you. How did that feel? Like, was it just like, this is mom?
Yeah, felt completely natural.
So like later, how did it feel to you after you met other people? Because you have all these crazy skills from your experience in some ways that just don't normally exist in a single person. So don't you think so? You're looking at me like, what?
Well, when you talk about skills, I think everybody grows up with sets of skills. It's just the skill set that I have is the one I grew up with. You know, I grew up with a remarkable bunch of adults, my mother included, and that was how we lived. We lived believing in ourselves. And I've always been an optimist and have believed in my ability to accomplish things when I'm inspired. I mean, that's a problem with me in jobs. Difficult for me to hold a job just because if it doesn't inspire me, I'm not interested. I'd rather go sit in the park and look at the sky.
Sure.
But that can be a problem sometimes.
How do you cobble it together? What do you do these days?
Well, I sell the copies of my book out of my backpack and selling my art collection.
Let me ask you this. Did your mom read your book?
Yeah, she read it. She liked it. She wanted me to change a couple of things, but I'm not going to change them.
Well, it's your book. You get to write what you write. It was clear that she knew and was involved in some sense with providing the information for the book. So I was just curious as to what she thought about it. Has your sister read your book?
Yeah.
What'd she think?
She calls it my adventure, my little adventure. And she doesn't like the fact that I put our family laundry out.
I found myself wondering how in touch you are with different people.
Well, the 2 half-siblings that I had passed away.
Okay.
One committed suicide. That was when I was about 16. And my other brother, whom you may know, he's a slam poet. His name's Kent Foreman. Huh. And he recently passed away about 2 years ago. I don't really see my sister or my mother much at all. But, you know, it's interesting. The question you asked me made me think about something else, which is growing up in that household, we have had I had so much exposure to such a wide variety of people
mm-hmm.
that as a little boy searching for a father figure, you know, whether the males in my life happened to be gay or alcoholic and heterosexual or whatever, I'd always kind of scan each person to see what kinds of qualities, the good qualities that they had that I admired. And then I would kind of go about adopting them. That would kind of be how I struggled with learning to be a man.
Mm-hmm.
At some point, I just dropped the whole topic of learning how to be a man, except, of course, when women come around.
Mm-hmm.
But it also, just to be exposed to such a wide variety of people, it really, you're talking about the skills that I have. I think one of the important skills that I have, that I know I have, is being able to talk to anybody, regardless of what class they are, how much education they have. I don't know if people spend enough time listening, just listening to each other. I think a lot of times people spend waiting for somebody to get done talking so they can put in their two cents,
mm-hmm,
without really getting what the other person's saying. That alone is a skill, just being able to listen. Mm-hmm. And I spent a lot of time doing that growing up, just listening to my mother tell stories, listening to and watching how adults interact with each other in that setting. Obviously, you know, I have a love for the gay community because they raised me. I think the richness of that upbringing really exposed me to the richness of humanity.
Mm-hmm.
Not just talking to people one-on-one, but also being able to appreciate the importance that fine arts has in everyone's life. You know, that if you look at a painting, that somehow it affects you,
mm-hmm,
in a way that nothing else has affected you before. One of the good things that came out of this experience that's not in the book is that I've learned to love myself and to love other people and to see people, to see the good in people. There would be times when my mom would put people up in our house, people she just met. She might have just met him an hour ago and they needed a place to stay. And she's like, yeah, he's going to stay. I don't know how long. He needs a place to stay. We got a 9-room house. They're going to stay here. And of course, I was like, damn, what are you talking about? Oh, shit. No way. I don't think it ever had a bad ending ever. And that exposure to the wide variety of humanity was one thing. But the other thing that I noticed was how my mother really just gave them the space to catch their breath if they were kind of in the middle of their own life crisis and to start to figure out what they're good at, how they could contribute. And mm-hmm, it started in our household.
Mm-hmm.
You know, my mom said, look, you don't have to pay rent, but do something around the house.
Mm-hmm.
And so I started seeing that everybody had something to contribute. Everybody in the world had something to contribute. So that's how I look at people. I look at people, all right, well, there's something that you're an absolute genius at. You're utterly talented at, and nobody's better at it than you. And I think that way about everybody that I see.
What does safety mean to you? When I was reading your book, I found myself thinking, like, that's scary, that's scary, that's scary, that's scary, and that's scary. And it made me wonder, what's scary to you? What does safety mean to you? Talk to me about those things.
I think what scary means to me is violence. It's chaotic and it doesn't feel good. You know, I want no part of that. It scares me to think I could end up in prison or dead. Being a black man in America now, I still probably could. The odds are way up.
You've made it past the dangerous years.
Well,
according to statistics.
According to statistics, but, you know, we know what's going on out there.
What does it mean to you to feel safe?
I think being safe for me means my daughter's fine. And I have the financial wherewithal pretty much to do whatever I want to do or need to do for her.
So tell me about your art life now.
I'm creating a national chain of marijuana dispensaries in states where it's legal, cited in communities of color. We will expunge the single drug convictions from their records if they want to come work for us. Then we'll also teach them how to create and preserve wealth.
Okay.
And then we'll give the company to them.
I was not expecting that. I'm so glad I asked that question.
So am I. It's called Cannabis in Color.
That is so interesting. So why?
Well, because, you know, there's been a disproportionate targeting of communities of color and incarceration,
mm-hmm,
around cannabis. And right now the cannabis industry is in its infancy, and it's going to start burgeoning once a critical mass of states have legalized it or the federal government's rescheduled it or reclassified it. But most of the people who are in the industry now and who are shaping the industries are not people of color.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, here in Ann Arbor, I don't think any of the dispensaries are owned by people of color at all. And that just seems wrong. It just seems unjust,
mm-hmm,
that most of the people who have carried the burden of being incarcerated and arrested because of cannabis are people of color, and they've been in jail. It just doesn't make sense that they should be excluded from creating wealth through this particular source.
Mm-hmm.
Part of the problem has been that a lot of people of color who want to get into the industry have this one drug conviction for a joint or a bag of reefer or something like that, and they can't get a job in the industry at all. And so that's why we have the component where we'll either expunge or seal that conviction. Now, the state of Washington, currently, they've got a bill pending in their state house that would automatically expunge any of those kinds of any cannabis convictions and would release people who are jailed just for cannabis convictions also.
Anything where you're on the cusp of a change
mm-hmm.
is going to be like wild westy. It's like moving pieces all the time, it seems.
Yeah. Well, there are a lot of moving pieces in the industry right now. You've got, you know, at least 22 states that have some sort of legislation in process or it's not adequate enough. And then you've got all these people who are in the black market. We're starting to come out because they've got dispensaries where it's legal and they've got a lot of money to invest. And there's a lot of pressure on the federal government and the state governments to start legalizing it. And then there's still some resistance because, you know, there's still a segment of the population that thinks it's going to lead to heroin use and it's going to kill people and it's not going to lead to any of that.
So for part of your school experience, you have this place where you're getting some kind of validation. Like, you know that people know that you're smart. You know that you're smart. But on the other side, other pieces aren't working out. We know that you went to school and then you finished and then you went to school again and then you finished. There's like a push and pull here that I'm interested in.
Well, the push is to get a job and the pull is to go back to school. That's pretty much what my strategy was. When I found myself at a crossroads in my life where I had to make a choice or get a job or do something else, I always chose going to school because I've always been successful in school. That was something I knew how to do school. Most often I had it paid for already and it was familiar to me. So yeah, that's really what it was. I mean, it was a very conscious thing.
Okay. Compare and contrast your MBA experience and your MFA experience.
Oh man, I'm glad you asked that question. MFA experience was a great experience. I mean, imagine living in La Jolla, California, right by the beach. But I got in on the strength of the rooftop murals that I had done.
Okay.
And they were really excited about having me there. And it was a great experience. I was able to work with Alan Capro, who's the founder of Happenings, and Faith Ringgold, Lewis Hawk. And I mean, I worked with a lot of people. My MFA thesis paper was actually requests to various government agencies asking that the public be allowed to listen in on their phone calls. Like one of those phones without dials would be like on a table in the lobby of the Department of Education. Mm-hmm. And you could just pick up the phone and you'd hear employees talking, you know, because I was asserting that those conversations were part of the Freedom of Information Act.
Mm-hmm.
I really documented how various politicians responded to my request, mm-hmm. how the actual agencies responded to the request. And that was okay. But it was a great experience there because I fit right in. I mean, mm-hmm. it was a natural for art school, of course, mm-hmm. right? Business school is a lot different. First of all, usually you come to business school, master's program, already having worked in the world, mm-hmm. right? Already having had a job in marketing or finance or investment, something like that. I didn't have any of that stuff. So I was really surprised that I'd gotten in. I had applied through the Consortium for Graduate Study in Management, which funds a lot of people of color getting MBAs. Part of that process, you had to put like five schools that you wanted to go to. Well, mm-hmm. Of course, I put Michigan first so I wouldn't have to move.
Mm-hmm.
I only got into one school. I only got into the one at Wisconsin, the one in Madison. And then once you get in, then they got to put you someplace. So they mm-hmm. put you in finance. They put you in applied ventures. They put you in real estate. They saw my background and they put me in the small business entrepreneurship.
Mm-hmm.
Well, for most of these, I was anticipating that I'd be able to go in there with this completely different point of view and really just kind of offer these just pearls of creativity that would just completely turn everybody around. And nobody wanted to have any part of that at all.
Tell me more about
that. Oh, man. Every time I'd bring up an idea, the room went quiet. My classmates, you could tell that the conversation that they were having with me was meant to sort of guide us away from whatever it was that I had suggested. It took me, I think, about a year to get over that. Now, before I went to grad school, I spent a year and a half bucking up my math skills because mm-hmm. I had to have calculus in order to get into business school.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I got accepted, it was provisional that I come in with at least a passing grade in calculus.
Mm-hmm.
But I had failed algebra. So how do you get to calculus You're not even doing pre-algebra. So for me, I went to Washington. I took pre-calculus, which was self-paced. And at the end, the teacher told me, you need to go through this again. You're not going to get through calculus. But I was on a time frame. So I jumped ahead. I started taking pre-calc, even though my teacher told me that I needed to take pre-algebra over again. But then I got a tutor, a great tutor. And she worked with me on pre-calc, and I passed that. And then she worked with me on calc, and I passed that. And so when I was actually in the classes at business school, the ones that involved math weren't as much trouble as I thought they would be. Really, what gave me problems was the information processing using Microsoft Access and putting together these different forms and figuring all that stuff out. And that was not a pretty picture.
So what are you reading right now?
I am reading The Wizard. It's a biography on Nikola Tesla. I am also reading a collection of Jewish ghost stories. And I'm also reading a third book, but I'm obviously not that into it yet since I can't remember the title.
A book juggler you are.
Yeah, I usually read about four or five books at a time. The last one I read was Mirrors by Galeano, a Spanish writer. And then I read The Rent Tent most recently. I was really moved. That was really just a stunner of a book. Wow.
You have a look of longing on your face, like, I want to experience it again.
Yeah.
Tell me about the importance of your religious background. Upon reading your memoirs, it seemed that your Jewish upbringing has been like a bedrock for you at times. And I'm just curious, is that still the case?
Well, I've only been a Jew. That's all I know. I went to nursery school at Hebrew school at the same place. My faith is, I mean, imagine what your faith means to you. I think it was the difference between ending up dead or in prison.
That's what it seemed like to
me.
That's...
Yeah. Because the center of good in my life was my grandmother, my Jewish grandmother who lived out in L.A. And even though I didn't have the same sort of immediate relationship with her that my sister did, which was really why she was able to get out. The moments that I shared with my grandmother were profound, and I've taken them with me. To this day, when I'm at shul, when I'm at Beth Israel, I feel my grandmother there with me. I love being a Jew, proud to be a Jew. Couldn't imagine myself being anything else.
Sure.
I have my regrets that I stayed away from any kind of a community while all this mishigas was going on in the book. Mishigas means craziness in Yiddish. By being at Beth Israel and going all the time, it's really deepening my faith, getting me in touch with parts of myself that I let go for a while. So I consider my relationship with God to be excellent and deepening constantly.
Sounds like a good place to be.
It is. Yeah.
From the book, it seems like your grandmother and your sister were in communication with each other, and your grandma maybe was helping your sister to hatch a plan to get out of there.
Yep.
And it sounded also that you weren't fully aware that this was happening when it was happening.
Correct.
Is that correct?
That is correct.
So what was that like?
You would think two children in that setting, only separated by 2 years, would be each other's best friends and help each other survive.
Help each other survive. Two kids in that environment look to each other to create that bond that one might need to survive in that environment. So your grandma's working with your sister to hatch her out, but she's not working with you to hatch you out.
Right.
And then your sister is working with grandma to hatch her out. But what about you? That seems like a punch to the mouth.
Well, I suppose I could see why you say that in hindsight. I mean, I didn't realize that was going on until I talked to my sister decades later.
Okay.
But I'll tell you, though, looking back, I wonder, how come I wasn't included in that? I never got a clear answer.
Also seemed like you were very committed to not leaving your mother alone in that sort of environment.
I think it was more that I was a boy. That's what I heard.
Okay.
Because that my grandmother didn't know what to do with boys. Some of it might have been that she didn't know what to do with a boy of color. Don't get me wrong. My grandmother's a wonderful person. May she rest in peace. She made a choice in the 1960s, in the late 1950s, to stick with her daughter who was having children of color.
Out of wedlock, you know,
out of wedlock, yeah. And so my grandmother, I loved her when she was alive, and I love her memory, and I'm proud of her. I wish I could have had more of her. Many times I've heard my grandmother talk about, your mother, she's got gold up there. she just, and then she trailed off, and you could see she was just frustrated because this is her oldest daughter who's, you know, like I said, she's got a, like a, almost a 200 IQ. She could be doing anything she wants. And my grandmother knew that. Her frustration was the same as my frustration. But if she can get Nancy out, fine. My sister Nancy, then she'd consider it something.
How many siblings did your mother have?
She had three. One died at a year old, and another one died last week.
Oh, wow. I'm sorry to hear that.
Yeah. And then another one died about 2 years ago. So she's the only one left now. Her sister, Judy, also was an artist, but married a nice Jewish boy who worked for the LA Water Department. They did fine. They had a son, my cousin. And then my other aunt, Serene, she was in the healthcare industry. Yeah, she did fine. Everybody was artistically inclined.
Mm-hmm.
My grandmother didn't understand art at all.
That's interesting.
But she put up all her daughter's stuff on the walls, of course. Quite the proud mother.
What was your grandfather like?
I never met him. And I think his death when my mother was 14 actually put her on a different path. Up until she was 14, she and her father worked tight. She and her mother never got along. So when her father got sick in like 1940, something like that, she would visit him in the hospital all the time. He had Hodgkin's disease, but back then they were just starting to learn about Hodgkin's. And then when he died, she began what she described as a moral free fall. Basically, she was angry, and they didn't do therapy back then. So none of her sisters, her mother, her, none of them talked to a therapist about grieving or issues that were unresolved because of their father's death. My mother started hanging out with the gay crowd. She used to go to Hadassah meetings. Hadassah is the women's Jewish group. And she would steal the fur coats while they were meeting in some other room. She would go to college and take what she liked. Eventually, she stole the University of Minnesota's marijuana garden and went to Chicago and picked out a different last name than her original, her legal, real last name, and settled in with the gay community there. And I asked her one day, I said, Ma, you think you'd be different? You'd have led a different life if your father was still alive or if he'd have lived into your 30s. And she says, I have no doubt of it, that I'd have lived a different life completely.
Yeah. Moral free fall is such a way to describe that.
Well, imagine your father dies when you're 13, 14 years old. I mean, I have a daughter right now who's 13. I couldn't imagine where she would be or what she would do emotionally if I died, God forbid, anytime soon.
You just brought up your daughter. I love the way that she walks through the library. Like, she's like, I've got questions and I'm going to ask. Like, there's just something about that I like so much. So when I read your memoir, I wonder how much of that is just her native personality and how much of that is like with you having the background that you had. It seems like you're like, listen, the world is yours. It's for you to make of it what you want. Is that true?
I think when you've had a child that almost died on you twice.
Sure. You had to be the one to actually save her life.
Mm-hmm. Since then, I have to say I'm not as strict as I've seen other parents. The way my mind is working when I'm with my daughter is we almost lost her a bunch of times. Mm-hmm. Not just the time that's in the book. A bunch of times. And I'm not really inclined to put restrictions on her. I would probably err in terms of giving her freedom mm-hmm. rather than restricting her.
Mm-hmm.
I also love that I'm her father because parents are larger than life. And I know that I'm larger than life for her. And I use that to tell her how great she is.
I think that a lot of times we talk about family. I think that sometimes we assume that family means to other people what it means to us.
Gotcha. Okay.
And it doesn't. The reason I'm curious about your answers is because based on what I read, it seems like these are topics that you have spent time thinking about explicitly. So I'm curious to hear what you have to say as someone who I believe has thought about these larger topics in a very deliberate and specific way.
Well, in terms of family, it was just me, my sister, my mother.
And
I always,
all those people, it was not just you guys. You just said, I have this respect for the gay community because these folks raised me.
Well, I felt as a child growing up that I wanted more brothers and sisters. Of course, there were these adults around me, but it's not the same as having a peer. It's interesting because when I was talking about masculinity earlier, what I was doing to address that as a child was I was asking everybody that I knew about my mother's father, because I had determined that my own father was a useless path to go down. He didn't want to talk about himself or his family. My experience with him is that I was always petrified and I never knew what to say, and it always seemed like it was wrong. And so I just abandoned emulating my father in any way at all, except to be opposite of what he was, and started looking at my grandfather, Arnie, his life. I started talking to my grandmother. What was he like? You know, was he this? Was he that? What would he think of me? And I did that for about 20 years. At the same time, I started doing genealogical research. Once I started getting into writing the book, I started really actually interviewing people about my grandfather. And then I went to the country in Europe where he was born. And
where was he born? There. I'm curious.
He was born in Latvia, in a town called Dwinsk, which is in the southeastern end of it. It's on the Baltic Sea. He's on the far inland side of it. So I did that, and I started talking to my grandmother about where she was from and their family, and we traced them back. And so I started to see that the lack I felt for family as a child, I was trying to put something in its place, and that was to learn about all of my ancestors that had come before me and to learn more about my grandfather also. I mean, imagine having a grandparent you'd never known. He died before you were born. You're getting something of his. Even if he was just the greatest guy and he spoke to your mother in just a wonderful way, you're going to get that vibe from your mother, right? So I had to ask all of my relatives about my grandfather in the hopes that it would point me in the right direction for maybe as to why I was the way I was, as to why my mother was the way my mother was.
So how are you? If you're asking questions about like why you are the way that you are, who is that person? Who is Keith Alexander?
Keith Alexander is a well-educated outsider, well-educated and creative outsider.
You like being an outsider?
Most of the time, yeah. Most of the time, I'm used to it.
Is that what safety feels like to you?
Yeah, I think so, actually. I think so. I think conformity would scare me.
What scares you about conformity?
Yeah, I think it would douse, at least I feel like it would douse what's unique about me if I were to conform. I mean, isn't that what conformity is?
Some people find great security in conformity. Somebody probably feels like conformity is a North Star.
Okay, and for me, oddballs and unique people, those are my North Star.
Interesting.
Not fitting in. That shouldn't be a surprise in the world we live in right now with all this craziness going on in politics. And who would want to conform? I mean, seriously.
Except, God. Okay, so
I thought we'd be wanting to run away from all that and shape something else that works.
But don't we run away from that? Many of us have the ability to create a very specific curated experience where you just only hear and only look at and only listen to the things that provide that cocoon for you. So in some senses, maybe we've done both.
Hmm. Interesting. Yeah, I suppose every life is a mix of conformity and nonconformity. I guess you have to pick your battles.
What question should I have asked you that I did not ask you?
I don't know. You've asked me questions I hadn't even thought about, which I thought were pretty gutsy. And then some of the questions you didn't follow up on, and I'm grateful for it. And I'm not going to tell you which ones those were.
What do you want anyone who's listening this to know?
That you can come up and talk to me anytime you like.
I saw somewhere at some point that you were working on developing your book into a screenplay.
Yep. That's almost done. I'm co-writing it with a guy I know from the neighborhood who's been working in Hollywood for a long time, and he has contacts there.
Okay.
So, yeah.
Well, we see it in your more memoirs. I know that you've also said that writing is not your primary art. You're an artist, but that this is not necessarily your preferred format.
No, it's definitely not. I mean, I seem to be good at it. I'm not going to say that I won't write again and that I don't like it. I actually enjoy it quite a lot, but yeah. Yeah, I do enjoy it. I absolutely do.
Mm-hmm. Music for this episode was Freedom by Jeff Wall, which you can find in the AADL catalog by going to aadl.org/magnitude. AADL Talks to Keith Alexander is a production of the Ann Arbor District Library.